fortunate. I ain't no fortunate, sir.
CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
And welcome back. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And as I say in the latter part, and that is now coming up, we're going to be talking with Judy Reaver about her book, In Praise of Blood, The Crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front. And by the way, Judy also has an article I urge you to read. It's in opencanada.org. And she's where she deals with the issues of her book in a short form to explain why we need to pay attention to this issue. And there are the subjects, which it's very immediate. We will talk to her about it in a moment. But she, Judy Reaver, has written this book, which took a lot of courage. And I think we are joined now by Judy Reaver. Are you there, Judy?
Yes, I am. Hi, Phil.
Hi. I do appreciate that we can get this chance to talk to you. I want to tell our readers that Judy Reaver is a freelance print and broadcast journalist who started her career with Radio France International before working for the wire service Agence France Press, reporting from Africa and the Middle East. Her reporting on Rwanda has been featured in 7 front-page stories in the Globe and Mail over the past 4 years. And she has been named a country of origin information expert on Rwanda by the Rights in the Exile program, which promotes the legal protection of refugees. Her work also has appeared in the foreign policy journal Le Monde Diplomatique. I hope I read this right. Humanosphere, a digital journal, and the Africa Report. Again, the title of the book is In Praise of Blood, The Crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, and it is available in, I think, all the Toronto libraries. I hope so. I hope everybody gets this book. Judy, I want to say I really appreciate that you've done the book, and at great risk, to personal risk, and that because it's a very well-written an essential book, because it provides a bunch of chapters that have been, I think, available for journalists to explore, but they have not explored them. You have. It's taken some time to write this, I gather. Maybe we should start with a kind of a personal detail here. You just lost a friend, a priest, an Italian priest, who was one of your sources. Is that right?
Yes, Father Giancarlo. Very dear man. He actually died of kidney failure, I believe. I don't have all the news of his death, which occurred last week, a week and a half ago. But he was crucial. I had been in contact with him. He was in Tuscany, in Italy, and he was one of the most courageous priests who lived in northern Rwanda for years. Before the RPF invaded in 1990, and then he lived acutely through the crisis of Kagame's troops invading from October 1990, the terror that the RPA, the Rwanda Patriotic Army, inflicted on northern Rwanda, specifically Byumba. And so he ended up, he told me these stories, because actually at first he was quite sympathetic to the Rwandans who had been exiled in Uganda for many years. But when he saw firsthand the level of terror inflicted during that invasion war, he completely changed. And so he lived with and also saw firsthand and documented the atrocities. as Hutus were being killed in their villages and then moving into a huge refugee camps before the genocide.
Mm-hmm. Well, that certainly underlines something that has bothered me over the years as I have followed this story. I remember reading in the New York Times when I was trying to figure it out what the heck was going on, and that was the days when you had to read the print edition, had a print edition, and I was reading a long account, and it said, identified Paul Kagame as a former general in the Ugandan army. And this was they were coupling this with the identification of the RPA as guerrilla. And so I remember standing up literally and saying, Ugandan army? General? You know, that doesn't sound like a civil war exactly. There's been a misdescription from the beginning, hasn't there, in terms of journalists getting it right as to who all these players were?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Paul Kagame is Rwandan, but he grew up in Uganda, as did thousands of his colleagues who were raised in Ugandan refugee camps, but also got educated and lived quite viscerally and benefited to some extent from the Ugandan state. And they became part of, you know, Yoweri Museveni's current president but former rebel leader of Uganda's army. And so Kagame and his colleagues, they were part and parcel, they were integral part of the Ugandan military, and they were Ugandan rebels that overthrew Idi Amin and Milton Obote. So the Ugandan army, in a sense, I mean, through the RPA, they invaded Rwanda. So that, I mean, how we call that, how we spin it is, or how they spun it at the time, I should say, is a debate you can talk about and labor over for hours. But clearly, they had the military backing of Uganda. When they invaded Rwanda, it was a, you know, transborder, and then Uganda was backed by the United States. So mm-hmm. that's really the essential element.
Mm-hmm. And on these matters of, to my mind, the chapters that have not been properly told, and your interest in and involvement, very close involvement with refugees, is certainly a necessary background for it. In northern Rwanda, there were, at the time of the dramatic events of 1994, the sort of definitive moment, there were already many thousands of refugees already, before the great conflict of 94. And I don't think anybody, if you were to read ordinary papers, most papers of the day, you would not have known that they were there. How many were there and what were their conditions? How did they, and by the way, why were they refugees? Why weren't they allowed to stay home?
The Rwandan Patriotic Army Kagame had invaded in 1990. And by 1993, there were the war against Hutu civilians in the north, villagers, peasants, was so savage that one of the founders of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, Alphonse Baruma, told me that the RPA was killing any Hutu on site. So you asked me the numbers. The numbers are at least a million people were displaced from their homes in Buyumba across a series of huge camps. And one of the former MSF humanitarian workers I interviewed who was there during the invasion war, he said that it just it was incredible, these refugee camps, these dotted the hillside for miles, for kilometers. And so if you can imagine, he said that the kind of poor hygiene and kids having no place to play, diseases were rampant, that there was no proper water, sanitation. And Father Giancarlo, who I mentioned earlier, you asked me about, said it was cataclysmic. It was biblical. There was so much suffering in this camp. And he said it was there that so Hutu youth began to radicalize. And so some of the Hutu burgomasters and mayors that tended to be more radical against the RPF invasion, seized on some of this sentiment. Yeah. So it was really, I mean, the conditions were frightful. Not a word of this in any Human Rights Watch or any Human Rights Watch report. When you're talking about the dearth of, you mentioned earlier, you didn't hear about this. There was nothing. There's a virtually a tragic gap in our documenting of what these people went through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my impression, I've had a few interviews with the former RPF people, and not nearly as many as you have, by the way, but it seemed to be a kind of a military political exercise. They didn't want any of the resident population of North and Northern Rwanda behind their lines. They intended to push them almost as a kind of an accessory to their advance.
Yes, that was their political military strategy. Attack the civilian population, push them from Uganda's in the north, of course, and push them slowly downward. That was their military strategy to the towards the capital. So that was a way to gain territory. And also, after Fred Rajima was killed during the first few days of the invasion in October 1990, Paul Kagame took over. And Fred's idea was, I think, from what I've heard, to negotiate with the Hutus, with the civilian population, and see, you know, move territory. He started attacking from a different area of Rwanda, not civilian populated area, but Kagame's approach was clearly a scorched earth campaign, and that's what he did. And it was to gain territory, and it worked.
Yeah, it certainly did. One of the obvious consequences was, you've alluded to it, is that if you this is an extremely poor country, and you don't accept you drive the refugee into your opponent's camp, and then you don't take, of course, you don't worry about feeding and clothing them, and they are destitute and very unhappy with the people who were represented their government. It created an extremely politically a toxic situation, which my impression is that that's what the RPF wanted.
Yeah, they wanted an explosive situation. Mm-hmm. It was always pushing, the Rwanda and its people to the brink. Mm-hmm. And also, it caused, unfortunately, tragically, retaliatory attacks against Tutsi civilians. Now, in some cases, those were attacks coming from Hutu elements. In other cases, there were staged attacks mm-hmm. by the RPA, by Kagame's army against Tutsis. Can you believe mm-hmm. this? It is true. It's documented. Mm-hmm. Former soldiers of Kagame's army have told me that there were staged attacks against Tutsi villagers, and all of this was done to increase animosity, make Tutsis more of a victim. They sacrificed Tutsis in order to demonize the Habyarimana regime and polarize the situation. So when I say they brought Kagame, they brought Rwanda to the brink, I mean, this was a very good example of it.
Yes. We're speaking to Judy Reaver. The book is In Praise of Blood, The Crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front. Incidentally, there's Judy's article is in opencanada.org, April 9. I urge you to read that as well. You put your finger on a story which, when I first was following all these things, it was a really powerful piece of journalism propaganda. I don't know how to label this, but I saw footage of bodies in the Akagera River. And it was, of course, horrendous to look at. And it was played over and over. We saw it many, many times. Actually, it always became the backdrop of the discussion of the liberating army the RPF racing to end the terrible regime after the death of Habyarimana. And checking this out, the New York Times, I saw an article, just I went back and looked at it, of April 94, and they talked about the bodies. And they said, these are the victims of the Hutu extremists, Inner Hamwe, et cetera. That isn't – you talked to many sources, and that isn't your conclusion. But could you talk about that?
Well, you're right, Phil. Those bodies, which came to – in a grotesque way symbolize the genocide, and it came to symbolize the horrible atrocities that Hutus had committed against Tutsis. And so we believe those bodies were Tutsis. These were the victims. But those bodies, which flowed along the Akagera River and then ended up in such graphic way, fed into Lake Victoria and were found up until Uganda, those bodies were mainly, my sources told me, mainly Hutus. And that is the tragedy of this, that as Hutus were fleeing those zones in the east into Tanzania, Kagame's army had quickly seized, controlled those areas in Buyumba and Kibungo Prefecture along that side of the country.
Yeah, they raced through eastern Rwanda. They basically captured it in very short order.
Absolutely. And by the 24th of April, a few weeks after Habyarimana had been assassinated, the Rwandan Patriotic Army was in control of the southern area of Kibungo, where Ingara and where those Hutus were fleeing and the survivors, but a lot of their families had been slaughtered. Those bodies were mainly Hutus. And someone last week called me and said, everyone knows that. He's a Tutsi. I mean, many of the officers and soldiers have told me this. But someone I know very well, he said, we knew this. We knew that those bodies were Hutus, but it was spun in mainstream media, New York Times, LA Times, and all the media as the demonization of the Hutu regime. This became a battle of good versus evil, and the RPF, which quickly seized the territory, was seen as the savior saving these people.
It was one of the rare times where the refugees, the people fleeing, were treated like they were rather demonized. I can recall reading Philip Gurevich and others basically calling mothers and children and anybody who had run from Kagame as a genocidier, and really, and of course, always being untruthful. Your article in opencanada.org makes a point. I suppose first of all, that we ought to listen and examine what they have to tell us. Could you talk about some of your sources? You have terrific sources, in my opinion. You talk to practically everybody.
Well, the first part of my research, I talked to victims. The Hutu refugees who had fled Rwanda during the genocide and who had stayed in Zaire, which later became Congo. I could not figure out, after I was interviewing survivors of attacks by Kagame's army in Congo, why they had stayed there for 2 years and let themselves, that's a strange way to put it, but why they were in eastern Zaire and were attacked in the first place. I said, why didn't you go back to Rwanda? And they started to tell me. And then I started to, this was bizarre to me, because I thought that Kagame had saved Rwanda and from genocide. And so I didn't understand at first. But the more they told me, the more I began to question. There were all the waves of the other refugees going into other countries that we didn't listen to. The UN had a protection report, had reported on those refugees we had just said. Those Hutus had been attacked, families had been slaughtered going into Tanzania. We didn't follow up. When I say we, I'm talking about human rights organizations and the United Nations. We didn't follow up on that. Robert Gersony did a report and tabled it in September 1994. That report was buried. He said that Kagame had and his troops had likely committed a genocide in one-third of the communes he had visited. There were just so many instances over the last, in the early years, and then in later years, of accounts, public accounts, that have been buried by powerful insiders. Yes. This is wrong, and we have to listen to the people who are fleeing today. We have people in Rwanda who are living in an open-air prison, and it's very difficult for them to say what's going on. But the point is, what I'm saying is, we need to listen to the people who flee.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, I think you also mentioned in the book that Kofi Annan would have been one of those who didn't want that report out. You notice, by the way, Kofi Annan, of course, has a little bit, he's a little too close to the problem, right? I mean, he was one of those people in New York who was advising and directing UNAMIR work. So if Gersony's report comes out, it's not exactly going to be good for Kofi's career, right?
No, I think, my sense, he was part of a group of people who buried Gersony's findings. Mm-hmm. They were in damage control at the time, and it was clear that they wanted to Kagame to consolidate power. They wanted to protect Kagame from these very damaging findings. Mm-hmm. And that was a decision that it is rooted in realpolitik and a lot of geopolitics, but that had devastating consequences on the security and the lives of so many people who lived in Central Africa for yeah. years to come. So that was a crucial decision, unfortunately, that was made.
Yeah. By the way, I think you're a great iconoclast because you're struggling with the shadows of very famous Canadians and famous people at the UN who kind of made their reputation over this issue, and their reputations have not been closely scrutinized for their role. But I want to call attention to one individual that I know you spoke to. This would be Colonel Marshall of Belgium. Mm-hmm. And, on April the 6th, I keep thinking, everybody was alive. They were all alive April mm-hmm. the 6th, and the president's plane, President Habyarimana, was shot down together with the president of Burundi, both mm-hmm. Hutus. But Colonel Marshall told you, and I think he tried to tell the world, his conclusion was it was RPF shot it, but that also he had been going to the CND, his personnel, to check whether or not the RPF might be engaging in improper behavior. They were in the capital at the CND, the parliament.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he was refused. So my question is, why didn't UNAMIR say they're not cooperating? This is a dangerous situation. We have a battalion inside the capital city, and they are telling me, no, I cannot inspect to see if they're bringing weapons into the city?
I think UNAMIR was unable to see fully what was going on. There were a lot of politics as well. UNAMIR was listening to sources that were planted by the RPF. There were constant grenade explosions, attacks, not only around Kigali, but throughout Rwanda. There was violence everywhere. You're right, Luc Marchal, who was the commander, UNAMIR commander in Kigali, he had a terrible relationship at the time with Charles Kayonga, who was the RPA commander at the of this 600-man battalion in Kigali of the Rwandan Patriotic Army. And the RPA was obfuscating, was not cooperating with the UN. Now, the UN should have sounded the alarm, mm-hmm. but I think they were dealing with so much destabilization and attacks that were being you know, staged by the RPA.
Yes, now it that's a, if I could just bring in, I've read Dallaire's book, and he, and in his interviews, he has a word he uses. He says, there was a third force, and I had to find out who it was. Well, it seems to have been the RPF. The assassinations attributed, and Alison DeForge and others attributed Gattabazi and others in assassinations to the mysterious Interahamwe linked people. But that the evidence goes the other way, does it not?
It absolutely goes the other way. What happened is during, I know you followed some of this, during the trial at Arusha at the UN Tribunal for Rwanda after the genocide, some evidence, very compelling evidence, came out to show that the RPF was behind this. But all the officers, RPA, ex-RPA officers and soldiers I've spoken to, plus confidential documents that I've accessed, show that the RPA staged attacks. They killed Hutu politicians in the run-up to the genocide to stoke as much instability and to push Rwanda to the brink. That's what was going on. They had commandos that they called technicians who were launching attacks in the capital. They killed Hutu politicians. And a lot of that disarray was blamed on radicals, Hutu, call them extremists at the time, but the RPA was doing that. And the RPA, Kagame's commandos, his technicians, had already infiltrated the Hutu militias, not just the Interahamwe, but the other youth wings of the political parties, the Hutu political parties. They infiltrated the political parties and their youth militias. So can you imagine stoking radicalism, stoking sentiment? And also, I point out in the book, they assisted directly in killing Tutsis at Roblox after Habyarimana was assassinated. Mm-hmm. So they wanted as many Tutsi victims as they could to not only demonize the regime, but use those victims as fodder for their moral victory.
Yes, and so that any subsequent violence would be able, writers like Mr. Grevich could label that reprisal, an understandable passion, and because of the bad ill treatment received by the victim.
Yeah.
Now, on April the 6th, I could do this quickly, but I want to make sure I get this in. When the plane was shot down, Marshall has said, and Dallaire in a more vague way, but I saw him do it in tribunal testimony. They both said that the RPF was in its starting blocks. You know, you can't just attack somebody. You have to prepare. The logistics have to be there. And so two things happened. There's the assassination, and then suddenly the RPF is on the move. You have a lot of documentation that they also assassinated Habyarimana.
Yes. I mean, Marshall talks about four RPF battalions in Kigali and getting into place immediately and mobilizing and starting their operations immediately. You can't do that without being completely prepared. Yes, and the evidence I have is that from confidential documents from the ICTR, the Special Investigative Unit that investigated RPA crimes, shows that the RPA had a commando team that assembled, was trained in the missiles, and then shot down the plane carrying Habyarimana and his Burundian counterpart and the other crew members. That testimony that is in the confidential documents I have matches more or less what Judge Jean-Louis Bruguière came out with in 2006. So the confidential document I have dates 2003, 3 years before Jean-Louis Bruguière came out with similar findings. It's very, very compelling evidence. It's probably the hardest evidence you know, they match, and it's, you know, the most conclusive evidence we've seen.
Mm-hmm. I wish we could go on because there's an awful lot, but the people will find it, our listeners, in Praise of Blood, The Crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, Judy Reaver. I think it's a very brilliant book, and it's absolutely essential to the people have this book. Judy, we thank you very much. I hope I can tell from reading it that you got more books could come. And we look forward to your writing.
Thank you so much, Phil. Okay. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Bye-bye. This is Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We have the song for Victoria Ingabire to take us out of here.
Ingabire, Victoire, Minoire, Victoire, Ingabire, Victoire, Minoire, Victoire, Ingabire, Victoire, Minoire, Victoire, Ingabire, Victoire, Minoire, Watubere, Inoire, Ingabire, Tirebera. Nabo Jesu mupira watubere inwaringabire.